You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This is Deborah Roberts, co-anchor of 2020. We're bringing you a true crime series from our colleagues at ABC News Studios called Wild Crime, Murder in Yosemite. Here's episode 3, The Skull.
Secrets in the wild. Brutal murders. Beautiful yet treacherous places. These are the stories of the investigators who solve crimes in the wilderness.
And then the skull was found.
Oh my God. We could maybe start to put a face with a victim now.
Put it out to the media with no success.
Lucas did start recanting his murders.
Some of those confessions were bogus.
And then not too long thereafter, three women went missing in Yosemite.
He would follow people. He would stalk them.
There's a family somewhere that their loved one is still missing all these years, and they have no idea what happened to her.
We're going to figure this thing out.
We're reverse engineering somebody's identity from their DNA.
They got a name for her. The other half of the case is now wide open.
When I was removed from the case, I thought, okay, I mean, whether I do it or somebody else does it, there's a lot of investigation that needs to be done. But in this particular case, the Summit Meadow case, I always assumed that there was someone who knew of the victim. Now, there are probably family members wondering where she is. So it was hard. My husband and I used to talk about it all the time. Do you think they'll ever identify the victim? And then the skull was found.
A visitor found it. And Lee Shackleton contacted me because I was the area ranger. See if we can find anything else. And we went out together to try to locate more remains or evidence. Now, as I understand it, the arm was found on the meadow side and the skull was discovered on the opposite side of the road where the ski trail begins to Dewey Point.
Typically in the Sierras, when we see bodies, they get distributed over fairly wide areas. Coyotes will take portions of the body back to their dens.
Kim and I talked.
We both thought probably it was associated with the Summit Meadow case.
It makes sense. It's a skull. That'd be the only other human remains we found besides what we found in the meadow.
They did a big search of the area. They didn't find anything more, but they had the skull. There's a family somewhere that their loved one is still missing all these years, and they have no idea what happened to her.
In 1988, I received a skull from the National Park Service. The skull had been naturally detached from the spinal column. Generally speaking, when people cut through things, they're not surgeons.
If somebody is dismembered or decapitated, typically we're going to see what we call sharp force trauma, cut marks on the bones. You can take apart limbs relatively easily if you know what you're doing, but taking apart a spine is really, really tough to do. Unfortunately, in this case, we don't have spine. We don't have a lot of those areas. So if this person was dismembered, there's no evidence on the bones we do have.
The skull is minus the lower mandible, the jaw, but all the rest of the skull's in fairly good shape. It allows you to make measurements of the length of the skull, different relationships of the face in terms of other structures on the skull. These numbers are used to make an estimate as to the sex of the individual and possible ancestry. The skull had characteristics that suggested Hispanic. However, this is a call that is made where there's a lot of error. What is Hispanic from a genetic point of view is a complicated issue. So when you say Hispanic, you say that's a possibility. The sex was female, and there was sufficient material to work with to do a facial reconstruction.
Oh my God, we can maybe start to put a face with a victim now.
In late 80s when this was found, the way they were reconstructing a face was with a clay modeling. Based on known tissue depths, they would place these markers on different points on the skull, and they built a clay model over the skull based on that assumption of a dark-haired Hispanic. This one had a very dark wig on it, and they put it out to the media. They got some tips. They ran through some possibles with no success at finding someone. It was the early 90s when I first had exposure to the Summit Meadow case. I was assigned to Yosemite, and my supervisor handed me a stack of files of cold cases, old cases. Basically told me, while I was learning the ropes here at Yosemite, my job was also to start looking into these and see if any of them were viable cases. There's a few Jane Doe cases over my career, and this one just seemed, I won't say personal, but it kind of latched onto me a little more. We were always pretty comfortable about Henry Lee Lucas being involved with the murder at Summit Meadow. The way Henry Lee Lucas described picking her up hitchhiking and then killing her and dumping her.
She's trying to go down. Okay.
With her hands or something else?
Yeah, with her hands.
And then some big story came out about basically laying out all this evidence where he couldn't have committed all these murders.
Bob Prince, the Texas Ranger coordinating the investigation in Georgetown, told me and anyone who asked that everyone on the task force expected Henry to not want to die. And one day he would claim that the confessions weren't real.
I've killed him in every way there is except poison. There's been strangulations, there's been knifings, there's been shootings, there's been hit and runs.
Everyone involved, from Phil Ryan to me, knew that eventually he would turn on us.
Lucas did start recanting his murders. He claimed to have, you know, found religion. He was this righteous Christian person now, and I think that was part of why he started recanting. But I mean, he was smart enough to realize that the longer he kept talking and saying things that law enforcement considered useful, the longer it would be before they'd get around to executing him.
There's not one shred of evidence showing that I committed any crimes. Not one shred of evidence. And nobody's going to commit a crime and don't leave a shred of evidence. No.
And he decided that he hadn't killed anybody, and he claimed that members of the task force had given him the case files, that he could convince the people who came to interview him that he was guilty of their crimes because he'd been coached by the task force. He was an innocent man who had been framed.
Andrew Lee Lucas embellished a lot. He claimed a lot of murders he didn't do. He wanted that attention. You look at me, I'm a tough guy, I kill all these people. He claimed, I think, 600 victims. Why wouldn't he recant? I mean, it keeps him in the press, keeps the focus on him. He wanted that attention. And I suppose at some point he wanted to save his own life.
There's proof that I haven't done the crimes. I mean, written proof, there's people that know I haven't committed the crimes.
You know, he'd get very emotional sometimes when he's talking about cases, and he'd get very emotional when he'd tell you that he'd been lying all this time. Now, which time was he telling the truth? Your guess is good as mine.
Once Henry recanted, it called all of the confirmations, all of the cases into question. Some cases were reopened, but not many.
Finally, and I guess it was 1998, Governor George W. Bush commuted his death sentence to a life sentence.
His confession, now recanted, was the only evidence which linked him to the crime. Today's knowledge about his pattern of lies raises doubt.
He died in prison a short time later.
I know he didn't have any guilt, but he had a whole lot of lies that he took to grave.
But only he really, really knew whether he had killed any more than just his mother, just Kate Rich, just Becky Powell, all three of which were horrible murders.
To dismiss him as a suspect is a mistake, in my opinion. I absolutely believe that Henry was guilty of committing murders across the country.
I don't think that an old case could absolutely be ruled out just because Henry Lee Lucas was the suspect. With Henry Lee Lucas, anything is possible.
Henry Lee Lucas recanting and then some of his confessions being disproved threw us for a loop, for sure. So yeah, we did some digging. We did find a window during this time when he says he picked up this woman that he could have been in California easily. The specifics of the crime scene, specific locations, descriptions, the evidence of the beer cans, which was always a big one for me. There was too much evidence to discount. I wanted to solve this. I wanted to resolve this. Then the hard part really came because we sat for several years, decades, because we had no further leads at that time. At a certain point, you hit a point of diminishing returns. You know, you're putting money and time into it when there's other crimes, other victims that need to be taken care of. I had to call it and put the case back in inactive status. One of the worst things I hated as an investigator is when a case I was working had to be suspended. You can ask the folks who worked for me and worked with me. I hated that. That felt like a failure point. You know, that was rough.
Then a number of years later, we have several murders that occur in Yosemite.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Libsyn Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
My name is Jeffrey Reinick, and I participated in the location arrest of the Yosemite Killer. The Yosemite murder case began in February of 1999, actually, the day after Valentine's Day. And it was the disappearance of three women.
Julie Sund, her mother Carol, and exchange student Silvina Peloso were last seen alive in mid-February near Yosemite.
Carol was the mom. She was in her 40s. Julie and Silvina were teenagers.
These three women were staying in a hotel at Cedar Lodge outside Yosemite.
When three women went missing in Yosemite, I and another agent went out there to assist the FBI and local law enforcement to analyze the crime scene.
The case grew into a case of national priority.
The haunting mystery of three women who disappeared last month outside Yosemite National Park took another somber turn.
Someone abducted them, murdered the mom and one of the young girls, and then took the daughter to another location where he sexually assaulted and murdered her.
Five months later, Joey Armstrong, who worked in the park, went missing. Eventually, they located Joey's remains in a nearby creek, and she had been beheaded.
Shortly after discovery of her body, Kerry Stainer was identified as a suspect. He was a handyman from Cedar Lodge.
Stainer worked at the Cedar Lodge for the past 2 years. It's where the three sightseers had stayed and a place Armstrong visited.
Kerry Stainer is a very interesting case because he comes from a very, very dysfunctional family to begin with. Kerry Stainer was born in 1961 in Merced, California.
The Stainer family was already well known publicly because their son, Steven Stainer, was abducted in 1972.
Steven Stainer disappeared on his way home from school in Merced, California. He was 7 years old.
And that had given the family a national attention.
Steven was abducted by a man, a stranger, a child molester, probably a pedophile, who took him into the mountains and kept him there for 7 years. Stephen and Kerry were brothers. Kerry was always sort of in the background because the focus was to find Stephen. And for years this went on. So Kerry was sort of almost like forgotten about.
There were times where his father was sitting in the family room in a way that indicated he was preparing to take his own life. And when Kerry would go up to talk to him, his father would tell him that, you know, my son's gone, who are you?
Then when Stephen reappeared after 7 years, if you look at some of the photographs of him, pictures, you can see Kerry was in the background, I'm here, but it was always about Stephen.
I was the supervisor of the investigations unit when the Kerry Stainer murders occurred. You know, that was 1999. We were loosely involved after the first three, supporting the FBI. We became very involved when Joey was murdered. Within a few days after her murder, Kerry was taken into custody.
They say they have found considerable evidence since discovering Armstrong's decapitated body last Thursday in the park near her home.
My boss was there, and he had asked me to interview Carrie Stainer. He was in an interview room. When I went in, Carrie was sitting in a chair, and he was facing the far corner of the room. And he said, I've done really bad things, really things where I'm ashamed of myself. I've just done horrible things. I asked him, are you talking about the three women from the Cedar Lodge? And he kind of did this long-winded nod. And he indicated there was more. He made some statements that indicated to me that he might be the person that is responsible for what happened to Joey Armstrong. And I asked him, you know, why did you take her head? Because what he described was he held her head for a while. I believe that Carrie Stainer was searching for intimacy. I've learned through the years that two of the most intimate times in life is when you're having relations and if you're holding someone when they die. I believe that he had absolute control of her, that it was a control thing. And I think with the absolute control and the fact that they were alone, this, I believe, is part of his quest to find intimacy. He held all of his victims when they died.
No one wakes up in the morning and says, today I'm gonna be a killer. You go through this long process, especially those who've been traumatized. It's about taking the power back.
He said, I've never told anybody this, but I was molested by my uncle.
He was traumatized, so we highly suspect that trauma then would have driven him to fantasize, create sexual fantasies that would be very, very dark, probably harming people.
I believe his fantasy started after he was sexually assaulted. He said, sometimes I can sit and think about world peace, and sometimes I think I can kill everybody in the world.
I had the opportunity to look at some of his paintings. Almost all of his paintings, about 15 of them he had done. The paintings were all about women's heads on the ground in the woods. And then he would have monsters hiding behind the trees. And of course, he was the monster.
Police all over the state are investigating whether Carrie Stainer, who's confessed to four murders at Yosemite National Park, might be connected to other murders.
When it came to Stainer, there is many investigators involved in that case who believe that these four victims were not his first.
I know from experience, most serial sexual killers will start to kill initially in their late teens or early 20s.
Carrie Stainer was 37 when he committed his murders at the lodge. And I suspect that he had some practice homicides where he learned from his mistakes. He could have picked up sex workers. He could have picked up hitchhikers.
He was always a loner and liked being on his own.
He would go to Yosemite National Park. He would know the area. And I suspect that in the woods that he would follow people. He would stalk them.
Carrie Stainer could be a suspect in the Helly Osborough case as well.
Helly Osborough was a woman that was murdered in 1985 in Yosemite Valley. She was hiking down a trail.
She was 18 years old, the daughter of a Danish diplomat. She she had come up to Yosemite to spend time in the park. She passed some tourists. They waved at one another and said hi. Moments later, those tourists and others heard screams, horrible screams. They ran toward the screams and found Hella bleeding to death with multiple stab wounds.
It was a brutal blitz attack.
She's not immediately dead. There's efforts made to resuscitate her, but she dies.
They didn't find the knife. They didn't find the guy. Nothing was found.
Nobody was ever arrested.
Stainer's weapon of choice was a knife, and at least two of his victims were killed with a knife, stabbing and beheaded Joey Armstrong.
He used to camp at the campground right near where Hella Olsborough was murdered. So in my mind, he couldn't be ruled out of that murder. We never had the opportunity to interview him or confront him about that.
He could have been in the park doing it in the 80s. I really still felt that Henry Lucas was our suspect, was responsible for it. But was it possible that Cary Stainer had something to do with killing our victim?
He'd have been about 20 at the time, 22, I believe.
Henry Lee Lucas said that he strangled her.
Without the body itself, there's no way we could tell if the person was strangled or stabbed or how she died.
But we didn't want to give up on that case.
The technology at the time had its limitations. I think we pushed those limitations as far as we could as an agency, and then we had to wait.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Throughout my almost 30 years stationed at Yosemite, the Summit Meadow case was always kind of on the back of my mind. Every time I go into the cold case file section, it was sitting right there, big letters staring at me. So when I became a supervisor, I tried to assign one cold case to every agent. Can we make progress on it, you know, given today's technology?
My name is Colin Tucker. I'm a National Park Service Special Agent. My parents were Park Service Rangers and criminal investigators. I grew up in Yosemite. As a kid, it was just a small town that just happened to be surrounded by a national park, and everyone was kind of linked in some way to the park. The Tucker family conversations would not be your typical conversations at most of the households. You know, my mom and dad would be trying to have a private conversation while making dinner or doing something, but we'd all hear it. It'd be my dad and my mom talking about work. I remember my older sister being like, "Mom used to be a cop, man. Like, you can't pull a fast one on her."
I've known Colin since he was 3 years old. You know, I worked with his father and his mother in Yosemite. I think over the years, the Park Service has had an issue admitting that there is serious enough crime occurring in national parks where you need a criminal investigator to work on it. You know, they don't want to admit that they're needed, and they don't want to pay for them. And so I think those were some of the big issues that caused that early group of investigators to get shoved aside. But when you get 20 to 50,000 visitors a day, they're going to bring their problems with them. There's just no way to avoid it.
Yosemite National Park was one of the first Park Service units that hired full-time criminal investigators to serve that detective function. And then other parks throughout the service saw the success of that and followed suit. In 2003, the National Park Service decided to take all the special agents across the country at these individual parks and make one national unit out of them. And that's what we know today as the Investigative Services Branch.
Now, I really had no idea at 21 that I would wind up as a special agent. My dad was very excited, very, very happy about me becoming a Park Service law enforcement officer. My mom was very like, do what you want. She's like, I mean, she was always like, please have a job, son.
We went in the military, came back, and became a ranger, and he showed an interest in investigations, and one of my goals was to hire him before I retired, because I just felt he had what it takes. And that came from watching him as a ranger and the way he did investigations. He put his heart and soul into them.
So in the Yosemite ISB office, above the door to the file room, we had all of our cold case missing persons flyers, and some of the flyers, the bulletins for our unsolved homicides. They would just kind of live taped to the wall above the door. And we did that as a reminder to be like, this is why we're here. I remember looking in the back file room on the shelves, and there's the Summit Meadow case file. And I knew just growing up that this was that case where my mom flew to Texas with Don and talked to a serial killer.
Yeah, it was in the National Forest up in there.
Yosemite?
Yeah, Yosemite. I had one that I dropped off someplace. She was just stabbed to death and thrown out of the car.
I've known about that, but I didn't know the details. I just knew that my mom did that. And I was like, well, what's up with this one, Jeff?
I decided that this would be a good case to assign Cullen. The fact that his mother worked on it 40 years earlier, was one of the original case agents on the case, thought it was just a good match. And if nothing else, he could learn all the things about the case and, you know, that maybe hadn't come up at the dinner table.
He called me up and he said, hey, Mom, I think I'm going to be working on the Summit Meadow case. And I probably said something like, well, that's good. I'm glad. I'm glad somebody is.
Cullen started really going over the case file with a fine-tooth comb.
The Summit Meadow case was opened in June 28, 1983. I wasn't even alive at that point. And so we had three or four binders and a couple file folders and a bunch of loose papers. And nothing's digitized. And so there's just binders that you have to go through. There really wasn't that much. But there's this like almost 20-year period where besides the facial reconstruction and maybe following up on a few random leads, there's not a whole lot happening.
We always assumed the arm and the skull were together just based on the location they were found and their appearance. You know, they both appeared to be out on the ground at the right amount of time to have been deposited at the same time.
In 2009, that's when they officially proved through DNA that the skull and the arm are the same person. They search CODIS, the DNA database, to see if it's related to any offenders or known missing people or family, and there's nothing. And so the case is eventually suspended in 2012, and there's nothing.
I'll be honest with you, when I first assigned it to him, I didn't expect much to happen. I just wanted him to get familiar with it and just because I'd seen some other people take a run at it, and there's nowhere to go. There's no more evidence.
The Summit Meadow homicide investigation has lasted nearly 40 years, and there's two generations of investigators now have worked on it. This unidentified skeleton has a name. We need to find it. We need to help bring justice to these people and these families. So my first goal in taking this case over was to identify who she was. The DNA profile does not match to any known family members in CODIS or any known offenders, your profiles in CODIS. The whole time I knew, like, nothing had worked yet. Let's, like, blank canvas, like, let's start over.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
One of the things that I wanted Cullen to do was to research and find a way for us to have a more hyper-accurate facial reconstruction.
The first facial reconstruction is the clay one. It's black and white. Well, the person who created it was working with a very limited set of facts and a very limited skeleton.
Cullen took that on. He talked with the National Center for Exploiting Missing Children, NCMEC, and learned about some technology. So the skull was taken in, they did a CT scan, then those results were sent to NCMEC, and they created this very hyper-accurate photo recreation drawing.
And then nothing really happens. And then all of a sudden, I'm catching cases. So I'm starting to work on these missing people cases in Yosemite. So I had some success linking skeletal remains to missing people. Some of the DNA stuff with missing people is like starting to come back, and it like worked. I was like, this is cool. This is how I'm gonna do this stuff. And then they started talking about the Golden State Killer. And he'd been on the news in California that they just caught the guy.
Police say they now have the Golden State Killer in custody.
The killer accused of murdering at least 12 people, sexually assaulting more than 50. 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo, former police officer, family man who was hiding in plain sight in suburban Sacramento.
They had linked his DNA to multiple crime scenes, but they didn't know who he was. And that's when they started reaching out to these ancestry databases for private genealogy. And eventually they identified Joseph DeAngelo.
They used DNA testing to find him. So many families are relieved this morning.
But the big take home is that this company called Parabon is doing this stuff. This is going to be the way of the future.
When detectives have DNA from a case and they want to help identify that person, they come to us. The cases that we work on, they are decades old. And all they know is whether the person is male or female. That's all that traditional forensic DNA can tell them. If you have a skull, they can use this pretty cool digital clay to mold and figure out what this person might have looked like. But it's still very broad. They don't know the person's eye color, their hair color, so the reconstructions generally have to be black and white because they don't have that information. What's so exciting is the DNA can now tell them that person's eye color, their hair color, the shape of their face, their ancestry, and help them winnow down who that person could have been.
I call Parabon and I tell them the story. And they're like, well, yeah, that actually might be something we want to do. And so that's like summer of 2020. I've kind of like just thought to myself, like, you know, we took it as far as we can. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
When the Summit Meadow Jane Doe samples came to us, they had DNA, they knew this was from a female, they knew her age, and that was about it. The question was, who was this person? We do a technique called whole genome sequencing, where basically it takes all of the DNA that was extracted from that sample and sequences it. We end up with millions and millions of pieces of data, and then we need to build that back into a profile of that person. That's where a forensic artist comes in.
They start off with a gray 3D head. My job as a forensic artist is just to turn it into something that looks like a normal, real human being.
Over many years, they thought the person was Hispanic. We were able to analyze that DNA and say, no, this is a person of European descent who's going to be very fair with blue eyes and blonde hair.
And I was like, oh my gosh. Right, like, holy crap. It was like Parabon like took a laser beam and was like, ba-dum, that's who it is. I was like, get to the good part. Who is she related to? Because once we know who this person is, like, the other half of the case is now wide open. In this investigation, the biggest piece of what happened has always been, who is this person?
We have two sides of what we do. The first is the phenotyping, the prediction of that person's appearance. The other is genetic genealogy. And that's where Cece comes in.
I'm Cece Moore. I'm an investigative genetic genealogist. Genealogy has traditionally been done through records. And so we would use census records, vital records, birth, marriage, death records. Genetic genealogy is using someone's DNA to learn more about their family tree and their genetic heritage. Investigative genetic genealogy is when we're using it for law enforcement purposes, either to identify a violent criminal or to identify somebody who has died without an identity. We're reverse engineering somebody's identity from their DNA. In the Golden State Killer case, that's what they did. They found common ancestors between people who shared DNA with that unknown Golden State Killer. They built forward from those people, and they eventually narrowed it down to just one person, which was Joseph DeAngelo.
When investigators used genetic genealogy to crack the Golden State Killer case, it was a watershed moment for how law enforcement solves crimes.
So the National Park Service came to Parabon and asked if we could use genetic genealogy to try to identify Summit Meadow Jane Doe. We had upload to the GEDmatch database.
Law enforcement doesn't access information from consumer companies that collect DNA, but they do use GEDmatch.
GEDmatch is not a DNA testing company. They are a raw data repository.
And people can volunteer to add their DNA information to GEDmatch.
And then GEDmatch runs a comparison against all of the hundreds of thousands of people who are opted into law enforcement matching. It basically gives us a list. Here are the people who share DNA with your unknown person.
And so if we can find a number of matches who share DNA with each other, we build their family trees and we look for a common ancestral couple or a common ancestor. I call that a genetic network. So I had these three sets of common ancestors that I knew had to be in Jane Doe's family tree. Now, I have to find someone who is descended from all of them. So because most of the matches in this case were so distant, I had to build those trees back to the early 1700s and even the 1600s in some cases. It took me a long time, but I finally found the triangulation marriage, the convergence of all of those genetic networks. I found a marriage of someone who descended from genetic network number one to somebody who descended from genetic networks two and three. We know it's a female, so it's got to be a daughter or granddaughter of this couple. So once I was finally able to zero in on that one couple, that one immediate family, it became obvious to me that one of their daughters had not generated any records since 1983. And when I found her photo and her high school yearbook, I was shocked how much it looked like the snapshot phenotype. So I felt very confident that this must be Summit Meadow Jane Doe.
January 4th, 2021 was my first day back to work after like holiday leave. And I open up my email and there's the second Parabon report. And we ended up calling them and it was Tom Shaw and CC Moore. And I was like, oh my gosh, we got a name. It was Patricia Hicks Dahlstrom.
Colin called me, and I'm not ashamed to admit we were both in tears because it had been a long, long road that we were finally going to give this family some answers.
I remember calling my mom, and I was like, hey, Mom, I got to tell you, like, we got a tentative ID on Summit Meadow. Her name is Patricia Dahlstrom, and I remember she started crying. I'm just bawling. She's like, you gotta call Don.
We've been waiting almost 40 years to actually find out who our victim was. Who would have thought that back in 84, when Kim and I are finding the evidence, and the next day she's taken off the case, that her son would come back in the same position that she was in and identify her? And all I could think of was like, wow. What if he solves it?
Oh my God. After all these years, I thought, well, okay. I mean, you're going to have to follow it where it leads.
Now we have a name. Now we have to kind of try to figure out how she died. How did this woman get to Yosemite and be murdered?
This is Deborah Roberts. Wild Crime was produced by Lone Wolf Media for ABC News Studios. Join us next week for the conclusion of Wild Crime, Murder in Yosemite. You can find the series streaming on Hulu, where you can also find 2020. And of course, tune in on ABC Friday nights at 9 for all new broadcast episodes of 2020.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.